This is Audible.
The Toymakers by Robert Dimmesdale. Read by Ruby Bentall. Surrender. Papa Jack's Emporium. London, 1917. The Emporium opens with the first frost of winter. It is the same every year. Across the city, when children wake to see ferns of white stretched across their windows, or walk to school to hear ice crackling underfoot, the whispers begin. The Emporium is open. Christmas is coming and the goose is getting fat. If, at a certain hour, on a certain winter night, you too had been wandering the warren between New Bond Street and Avery Row, you might have seen it for yourself. One moment there would be darkness, only the silence of shops shuttered up and closed for business. The next, the rippling snowflakes would part to reveal a mews you had not noticed before. And, along that mews, a storefront garlanded in lights. Those lights might be but pinpricks of white, no different to the snowflakes, but still they would draw your eye. Lights like these captivate and refract the darkness. Lights like these can bewitch the most cynical of souls. Watch out, because here one such soul comes, hurrying out of the night. He is a barrel of a man, portly to those who would look on him kindly, corpulent to those who would not. Outside the Emporium, he stops and gazes up. But this is not the first time he has been enchanted by these lights, so he steps through the door to be met by the whirlwind smells of cinnamon and star anise. Ribbons of navy blue stream apart, and in the vaulted ceiling above, miniature bells tinkle, spiriting up memories he has tried hard to forget. Sleigh rides through parks too painful to remember, were sailing on the village green, Christmases in better, more innocent times. Come. Go in after him. You would not be the first. Children are already tugging on their parents' hands. A pair of young lovers hurry to make secrets of their gifts to one another. An old man unwinds his scarf as he hobbles in, if only to feel like a boy again. If you follow after, there will be much to see. He is already disappearing into the throng when you come through the doors. What had seemed a tiny shop from without reveals itself to be a grand labyrinth within. At your feet, a miniature locomotive glides past on rails set into the floor, and beyond that, each aisle explodes into a dozen others, floors stacked upon floors like the illusion of a master mathematician. Shoppers disappear along one aisle, only to reappear bewildered on the galleries above. It would be easy to get lost in a place like this, but the man we are following knows the way. Alone, among the shoppers, he does not stand to gawk at the displays, and nor must we. There will be time for lingering later. For now, do not let yourself get distracted by the bears whose eyes follow you from every shelf, nor the tin soldier who stands to attention as you pass. He is only playing a parlour trick to tempt you into taking him home. Forget, for a moment, the whinnying of the hobby horses eager to be ridden. If you see a doorway through which there lies a wintry grove bedecked in lights, do not give it a second glance. Keep your eyes on the man in front, for he is almost at his destination. Come closer now, that we might listen. The man, let us think of him as a friend, queues at the counter. Before his turn comes, there is a family laden down with a nest of silver satin mice, and a lady who must keep the Russian dolls in her basket from clambering out of one another in their haste to be bought. By the time our friend reaches the counter, he is purpling with impatience. "Madam," he begins, "you may recall me. I have been coming here more Christmases than I remember. I came here not 1 week ago to find a present for my sons." The storekeeper may or may not have been the one to serve the gentleman. The Emporium has been a maelstrom of activity since before this century was born. Its storekeepers are many and increasing year on year. Every new toy demands a new assistant. New atriums and playhouses are being discovered with every exploration. She does not remember, but she nods all the same. All are welcome at Papa Jack's Emporium, for everyone was once a child, no matter what they've done or whom they've grown up to be. How are your boys enjoying those toys?
Our friend is incandescent. He sets his leather briefcase upon the counter and opens it to reveal a battalion of toy soldiers, wrapped carefully in the crepe paper in which they were bought. Upon bringing them out, he lines them up in formation, sparkling creations of varnish and wood.
Well, he says, and here he pauses, as if he is himself confounded by the thing he is about to say. Picture it, if you would. It is Christmas morning, and two boys are tearing open their presents. Imagine how thrilled they were to see these. So noble and proud, so lifelike. Well, they wanted to play their battles there and then. But it is Christmas, and first there must be church, and then there must be dinner, and then, only then, can the boys set out to play. I tell you this so that you can see they had waited all day for their battle. So when the time came, and they lined up their soldiers across the parlour floor, you can imagine how excited they were.
And what happened?
It is perhaps better if I show you. The customer takes three soldiers and positions them at one end of the counter. With great care, he places an opposing force at the other end. If you would, he says to the storekeeper, and as he winds the first soldiers up, she winds up the second. At opposing ends of the countertop, the soldiers start to march. You can quite imagine their excitement. Noah was crying out for victory. Arthur could barely contain his delight. Which one would win out? They started asking. Father, Arthur cried, come and see. So I did. And what do you think I found? On the countertop, the fronts have advanced. Some other customers have drawn near, lured by the commotion. See the woman with the cage of pipe-cleaner birds, the vagrant soldier marvelling at the stuffed dogs lounging in their baskets. Keep a careful eye on them. You will see them again. But, for the moment, bring your gaze back to the battle. The soldiers are almost on top of one another. Three more paces and the fronts will collide. According to the rules of boyhood battles, the last soldier standing will reign supreme. One pace, and rifles still drawn. Two paces, and the barrels of those rifles hang so closely that the opposing soldiers can see into their beady black eyes. Now, at last, is the moment all have come to see. Then, the soldiers stop. On each side, the soldiers spin their rifles, holding them aloft. And, on the end of those rifles, hang rippling white flags. Each figurine lifts a hand to grasp the hand of the soldier it was sworn to kill.
Well, our friend demands, what is the meaning of it?
The storekeeper has stooped down to study the soldiers, the forces so interwoven that only a boy of the keenest eye could separate his own from his playmates. Our friend is telling her how it happens every time, how Christmas morning has been ruined and reparations must be made. But the storekeeper is silent, and none could miss the beatific look she is trying hard to keep out of her eyes. These simple toy soldiers, these lifelike recreations on which the Emporium has built its empire, these playthings that have sat upon the shelves for as long as the store has existed, who have provided generations of boys with untold delights, have, for the very first time, lain down their arms.
They have surrendered, she whispers,
and she doesn't care at all for the outrage of our friend, for the money she must pluck from the till and return to his hands. The soldiers she is staring at are happy now, and it is the most incredible thing. In the beginning. Situations vacant. Dover Court to Lee-on-Sea, November 1906. They brought her down to Dover Court to sell her unborn child. Mrs. Albemarle's home for moral welfare did not have a sign to proclaim itself outside the door. A wondering eye might have caught the curtains closed during the day, and the neighbours could not overlook the steady stream of girls who passed through its doors. But to passers-by it was just another palatial home off the seafront, a double-breasted affair of Georgian design with whitewashed walls and balconies garlanding its bedrooms. To Cathy, who had known nothing of it even as she was bundled onto the omnibus this morning, the door had a magical effect. By filling her body with dread, it somehow quelled the nausea she had been feeling for days. They stood in silence outside the door, with seabirds wheeling overhead. Kathy's mother flicked her finger, and Kathy knew without asking that this was an instruction to knock. She did so tentatively, hopeful she might not be heard. But such good fortune had been in short supply this winter. After some time, the door drew back, revealing a hallway bedecked in floral designs. The woman in the frame was wearing a bright gingham house dress. Her square shoulders and significant chin gave the appearance of a woman unused to idleness, and indeed her sleeves were rolled up, her forearms dusted in flour and shreds of dough. "You must be Catherine," she said, acknowledging Kathy's mother with barely a flutter of her eyes. "Kathy," Kathy began. It was the most defiant thing she had said all day. "When the time comes for you to reside with us, you'll be Catherine," the woman returned. "We deal in propriety here." At this she stepped aside. "Come in, Catherine. We'll have this sorted in a trice." The home had once been a minor hotel, and in the common room the decor had not been changed. Kathy sat alone in the bay while her mother and Mrs. Albemarle, for so the woman had introduced herself, spoke about the essentials of Kathy's future stay. As they were speaking, other sounds drifted through the common room, past the little table with its pile of dog-eared Reader's Digests and Lilliput magazines. Somewhere in this building babies were squalling. There were no words, only shrieks of glee, the bleating of a creature still growing used to the sound of its own voice. Kathy was listening to them so intently that she did not hear Mrs. Albemarle calling her name. It was only when her mother added her flinty tones that she turned. "This way, Catherine." There was no choice but to follow. Mrs. Albemarle led her along a back hall and into the cramped office at its end. Here, behind a desk on which sat a tarnished typewriter, Mrs. Albemarle took a chair. She had produced a form with black boxes, and now she ferreted in a drawer for an inkpot and pen. When none was forthcoming, she settled on a pencil, using it to direct Kathy into a seat. "How old are you, Catherine?" Catherine. That had been what her mother called her as well. Her father had been unable to utter a word. "She'll be 16 by the time you take her," interjected her mother. But Mrs. Albemarle lifted an admonishing finger. "She must speak for herself, Mrs. Ray. If she's old enough to be in this position, she's old enough to do that." She paused. "Perhaps you had better..." Out came the pencil again to indicate the door. Flushing crimson, Kathy's mother retreated into the hall. "There, that's better. We can speak freely now, can't we, Catherine?"
"I'm 15," Kathy said. "And my name is Kathy, not..."
"And the date of your birth?"
"The 24th of May, 1891.
Mrs. Albemarle made notes, stopping intermittently to press her tongue to the end of her pencil. "And how far along are you?"
For the first time, Kathy's skin darkened.
"Catherine, dear, it isn't a test. Do you know how far along you are?"
"No."
"But you have visited a doctor?"
She had, because her mother had taken her. His fingers had been gnarled and cold. She had felt his wedding band icy against her inner thigh.
Deciding to take a different approach, Mrs. Albemarle asked, "How did you know you were carrying a baby, Kathy?"
"By God, but she hadn't.
It was her mother who'd come to her, because it was her mother who brought fresh linens each month. She'd been feeling unsettled for days, hardly wanting to eat, even when her sister was baking rye cakes on the range. But only when her mother crept into her bedroom at night had the pieces fallen into place. "You're late," she'd said in hushed but virulent tones. By the look of her, she'd been brooding on it for days. She'd even waited until Kathy's father was away, drinking in that squalid little hole down by the cockle sheds, just in case she was wrong. But no. The moment she said it, something broke inside Kathy. Something made sense. There was a chasm inside her. She wanted to call it an emptiness, only that was the opposite of what it was. Something was growing. A seed had sprouted shoots.
In that moment she knew that there were the buds of arms and legs, the four tiny valves of a heart. She had sensed it beating as she tried to embrace her mother, but her mother had staggered backwards, refusing to be held. She'd probably said things after that, but sitting here now, Kathy couldn't remember. After her mother was gone, she had turned around and been sick into her bedsheets. Strange how you could keep hold of it when the sensations were without explanation. As soon as she knew, it came out of her in floods. "And the father?" Those were the words which jolted her back into this cold, stark room. "I'm presuming you do know who the father is. Now, look here. Understand, Catherine, that we need to know these things. They're the sorts of questions people ask. Why? Nobody wants to bring a cuckoo into the nest. They want to know where their baby comes from. They want to know about the mother and the father, if they've got breeding."
"He's a local boy," she admitted. "He's my..."
"You're courting?"
"No," she wanted to say. It wasn't like that.
Daniel lived in the house at the end of the lane, the house with the big gables and the grounds and the wrought iron gates she had stopped up here in every day on her way to school. By rights, they should not have been friends. And yet they had been friends since they were small, and that summer her mother worked in the grounds. Theirs was the purest form of friendship, the one that begins even before you can talk, a friendship of gestures and grunts, toys quietly offered and toys eagerly snatched away. They had walked to school together and caught first trains together. They had gone caroling, picked dandelions, eaten pastries at the harvest festivals, held in the grounds of his home, such a lavish affair. And when, one afternoon, she had met him by the back gate and they had done other things together, well, it didn't feel unusual and it didn't feel like courting at all. Even afterwards, when she had decided it was a thing they would not do again, it did not feel so very strange. She did not know, even now, why a thing like that had to change the world. She realized she had tears in her eyes. That wasn't Kathy's way, but there was another creature inside her. Possibly these were its tears, and Kathy merely the conduit. "Has he taken responsibility?" "His father wouldn't allow for it. Not with a girl like me."
"A girl like you?"
"You mustn't marry down, Mrs. Albemarle."
"Yes," said Mrs. Albemarle. "They won't marry down, but when it comes to the rest, they wouldn't care if you were a scullery maid or debutante. What about the boy himself? This friend of yours?
Put up a protest, does he? Cast off his considerable inheritance to look after his bastard born?"
"Oh," Kathy said, and for the first time allowed herself the merest bitterness. "Daniel's a good boy. He'll do what his father says."
"They're to send him to Derby. Their cousins own a mill." For a moment Mrs. Albemarle was silent. Then reaching across the table as if to take Kathy's hand, she said, "Catherine, understand that. What we do here, we do it for the very best. Your baby will rise from the shame of its beginnings and find a new, better life." The way Mrs. Albemarle was smiling returned the nausea to Kathy's stomach. She was too late to excuse herself. In Mrs. Albemarle's office, the smell would linger for days. Her mother barely said a word as they waited for the omnibus home. Shame had compounded yet more shame. The stains on Kathy's dress didn't help. And perhaps she would have taken a different seat altogether if only the vehicle hadn't been so crowded. Back in Lee, where the smell of seaweed cast up on the estuary sand stirred such vivid recollections, Kathy followed her mother through the door. Caught in a whirlwind of memory and scent, she took off her shoes and ventured further in. How many times had she come through that same door, laden down with shopping and heaving on her mother's hand? How many times had she scurried in unbridled excitement along this hall, having spied her father tramping home from work? And now, there he was, eating his dinner of pork and beans, steadfastly refusing to look up as Kathy hovered at the dining room door. "Upstairs," said Kathy's mother.
She had already closed the door, and the last thing Kathy saw was her father studying the marbling of marrow from a bone on his plate. He still hadn't looked up. An onlooker might have thought pregnancy was catching, that if she stayed around a second longer, Kathy's sister,
now locked in that room with their father, might suddenly issue forth some progeny of her own. Wordlessly, Kathy followed her mother upstairs. In the bedroom that she shared with Lizzie, the shelves had been denuded of her books. The toy chest and doll's house were both gone, and the rabbit figurines that ordinarily lined up so prettily on the window ledge had been spirited away. "Don't start with me, Catherine. It was your father's decision, but I'll brook no nonsense from you. If you're old enough to be a mother, you're not a little girl any more."
"I'm sorry, Mama." She felt sick after she said it, but at least that complemented the nausea already bubbling in her gut. It was a pointless gesture anyway. The words did not penetrate her mother's resolve. Instead, she began to reel off a list of instructions. Catherine was no longer to go beyond the front door. A letter would be sent to her schoolmistress instructing that she had taken work, and into the back garden only with the express permission of her mother. Catherine was to dress only in clothes that might hide her swelling stomach. "It's only for 3 months," her mother concluded. "Then you can go where you need to go and come back to us afresh, our own little girl." After she had gone, Kathy took in the room. How big it looked, emptied of all the tokens of her childhood. She tried to make herself comfortable on the bed, but conversely it seemed too small for two at any rate. She was still lying there, curled up like a question mark, when the door opened again. Expecting her mother, Kathy turned against the wall, but in the corner of her eye she saw Lizzie sidling through. Lizzie was the taller of the two. Her hair was blonde where Kathy's was dark, but they had the same grey eyes, the same high cheekbones. Common knowledge, the knowledge of the neighbours, held that Lizzie was the prettier, and she held herself that way too. Only once had she ever climbed a tree, and even then Kathy had to scramble up to help her down.
"Kathy, it's me. I..."
Kathy crumpled. She opened her arms and Lizzie dropped beside her on the bed, and then they were clinging to each other as they had done when they were small, waking together in the night to hear the sea making war against the coast. For a time, neither said a thing. For Kathy, it was enough that she was here. There was a look on Lizzie's face that might even have been excitement. Her eyes kept flitting to Kathy's stomach as if she might see a little face there, pressed up against the cotton of her blouse.
"What does it feel like? Does it feel special, Kathy?"
As a matter of fact, it did. It felt hot and righteous, like none of the scorn nor shame mattered, like nobody else on the planet had ever done it before. That was how special it felt. And yet, all Kathy said was, "You shouldn't be in here. Mother will explode if she knows."
"Chastened," Lizzie whispered, "I wanted to bring you this."
She had produced a newspaper, a day-old copy of the local gazette their father trawled through each night. It would be something to while away the sleepless hours, Kathy supposed. That, or something else to throw up into when the feeling next came. Yet, as she took it, she felt something hidden inside. She laid it on the bed and opened it up, and inside was the same dog-eared copy of Gulliver's Travels that had sat for so long on the cabinet between their beds.
"Do you remember it?"
Kathy clasped Lizzie's hands.
"Hide it. Take it with you when you go. Oh, we loved it so, Kathy. Maybe you'll have the chance to read it to the little thing before they..."
Lizzie could not bring herself to finish the sentence. Instead, she kissed Kathy full on the lips and vanished through the bedroom door. After she was gone, Kathy picked up the book, smelled its pages. That scent was the scent of being 5, 6, 7 years old. Funny how quickly it could transport her back there. For some time, she savoured old sentences. Until finally the sweetness turned to bitterness, and she buried it beneath her pillow. She was drying her tears, the room coming back into focus when she saw the newspaper lying on the bed. It had fallen open at the situations vacant. There she saw the calls for tinkers and joiners, for shipwrights and salesmen, all the usual fare that her father entertained and dismissed as a daily rite. She was still staring at those adverts when her eyes were drawn to a smudge of black on the opposite page. Between a notice for a removals firm and an advertisement for a bonfire celebration to be held on the point, another notice had been circled in ink. "Help wanted. Are you lost? Are you afraid?
Are you a child at heart?
So are we. The Emporium opens with the first frost of winter. Sales and stock-taking, no experience required. Bed and board included. Apply in person at London's premier merchant of toys and childhood paraphernalia. Papa Jack's Emporium, Iron Duke Mews, London.
There was a different quality to the letters, something that made them appear to float at an infinitesimally small level above the page. How her eyes had glanced over it before, she did not know.
Kathy ran her hand across her belly, pretending she could sense the tiny kicks that would one day come. Though she felt nothing, she could still imagine it. The he, the she, the unformed promise of days and years to come, tumbling in unrestrained delight within her. How could something so beautiful be the worst thing in all of the world? Something drew her eyes back to the advert, refusing to let them go. Because an idea was blossoming inside her. An advert like that had to be circled for a reason. Certainly it had not been her father.
A message, then? From Lizzie to her sister, compelling her to run?
Yes, she thought. Run. She was still staring at the newspaper as the soft autumn darkness descended. In the house around her, time was slowing down. She heard the familiar rattle of doors being bolted and the fire being stifled in the grate. Once upon a time, there would have come a tapping at the door and her mother would have peeped in to whisper her goodnights. Tonight, there was only the long silence. The lamp on the landing fizzled into blackness, and Kathy was left, still staring at the advert by the silvery light of the stars.
Sales and stock-taking. That sounded simple enough. No experience required. That seemed an invitation too good to be true. And, if she wondered why there was an advert for a store in London so far outside the city itself, her bewilderment did not last long.
London, she thought.
Yes, she could disappear in a place like that.
People went missing in London all of the time.
The Girl in the Toy Shop. Leon C. to London, November 1906.
Running away was not like it was in the stories. People did not try and stop you. They did not give chase. The thing people didn't understand was that you had to decide what you were running away from. Most of the time it wasn't mothers or fathers or monsters or villains. Most of the time you were running away from that little voice inside your head. The one telling you to stay where you are, that everything will turn out all right. That voice kept Kathy up almost all of the night. In the darkest hour she sat in the window, one hand cupped around her belly, the other holding the advert up to the starlight that cascaded through.
"And what do you think we should do?" she whispered. "It isn't just me, little thing. It would be you running too."
The answer came in a rush of feeling, of love and nausea and imaginary kicks. Her mind made up, she was awake before dawn. She could hear the house coming to life, the fire being stoked in the grate. She watched from the window as her father set out into the dark. She watched sometime later as Lizzie disappeared for school, just another ordinary day. Later still, her mother brought her toast, depositing it without a word. Even then there was that little voice in the back of her mind. "Stay where you are," it was telling her. "Everything will be all right." But everything wouldn't be all right. She knew it, with the same sinking inevitability that she knew she would not keep the toast down this morning. Even her stomach was mutinying against her. There was so little to take with her. 3 clean dresses meant for school, socks from the drawer, the copy of Gulliver Lizzie had meant for her to have. The few pennies she had saved were meant for Christmas gifts, but she pocketed them all the same. Goodbyes would be in short order today. She did not want to make one to her room. It would only lead to tears, and tears would only keep her here. So without looking back, she went out onto the landing and hovered at the top of the stair. Down there, her mother was lost in a clattering of buckets and mops, pots and pans. Kathy paused once at the bottom of the stairs, but it was not a second thought holding her here. It was only the realization that this place where she had been raised, where she had squabbled and sobbed and sought comfort in her mother's arms, wasn't hers. It was already changed. So, without a moment of regret, she stepped out into the bracing November air. After that, all she had to do was walk. The station sat on the seafront, only a short walk along the estuary sands. If anyone looked at her on the way, they saw only simple, smiling Kathy Ray. They did not see the baby she brought with her. If they noticed the way she kept glancing over her shoulder, fearful of being followed by some fisherman friend of her father's, they did not try to stop her. And when finally she stood on the platform, ticket in hand, she understood why. The world cared nothing for a single runaway daughter. It had seen the story so many times. Alone, she boarded the train and watched the seafront sailing past. Kathy had ridden the train before, but never with the same sense of freedom. Was there a word for having done something wrong and yet so terribly right at the same time? If not, she would have to make one, a word for only her and her child. She pressed her face up against the window as the towns and rags of country flickered by. London was stealing up on her by degrees, the railway sidings and towns becoming a city only in those moments when she looked the other way. One moment she was passing through the shadows of Upminster, the next the platforms at Stepney East. By the time she stepped off the train, all the other passengers fanning out onto the streets, she had quite forgotten the exhilaration of escape. It was a revelation to know that, after all the pious staring of the last 6 weeks, she was a nobody again. She had been to London once before, but that had been in the distant past, and all she remembered of that trip was a cafe with checkered tablecloths, sausages and chips, and ice cream. A holy dinner, if ever there was one. Now she found herself coming down the steps into a city she could not understand. A horse-drawn bus was sitting in front of the station, while the pavement heaved with office clerks. It was best to keep her head down, to barrel on, even though she only had the faintest idea in which direction to head. By instinct, she picked her way to the tramline and watched as 1, 2, 3 trams rolled past. When the fourth came, she found courage enough to ask the driver if he knew where Iron Duke Mews might be. "Somewhere up west," he said, and invited her aboard. Soon the driver summoned her up and set her back down. Regent Street was dizzying, and no place for a girl whose nausea was growing by the minute. All she could do now was hurry on, putting her trust in whatever lay at the other end. Fortunately, Iron Duke Mews was not far away, though it took her some hours weaving in her own wake to find it. She had circumvented the overwhelming opulence of Claridge's Hotel 3 times before she saw a regiment of children bullying their nursemaid along the row. Though the nursemaid looked harassed beyond measure, a smile was playing in the corner of her lips. Soon, Kathy began to see others. A father with a son tugging on his hand, a Kensington couple carefully controlling the chaos as their 3 daughters cavorted around them, all heading in the same direction. But it wasn't until she saw others returning that she knew she was right. A grandmother, dressed as if expecting a night at the opera, was leading her grandson out of the alley, and in his hands was a wooden sled, harnessed to tiny woolen dogs. They seemed to scrabble in his palms, while the sled floated on air behind. Iron Duke Mews opened in front of her, and there, in the kaleidoscope of lights at its end, she saw Papa Jack's Emporium for the very first time. It was a double-fronted building, dominating the dead end where the alley turned in on itself and forbade further passage. Papa Jack's Emporium, it seemed, was a destination, not some place to be discovered by pedestrians idling by. The entrance was a Gothic archway, around which heart-shaped leaves of the most fearsome red had been trained. On either side stood windows of frosted glass, obscuring the myriad colours within. The edifice of the building was speckled in lights, like snowflakes rendered in fire. Kathy had never seen electricity used like this, had not imagined it could be so giddy or enchanting. Smells were calling out to her too, gingerbreads and cinnamon that plucked her out of this November night and cast her down in a Christmas 10 years ago. She was still staring as a family emerged, trailing behind them a dirigible balloon. As long as a motor car, it bobbed along at the height of their heads, while in the gondola below their 2 toddlers turned and gaped. One of them caught Kathy's eyes as he was borne past. "I'm going to have to talk to you, little thing," she whispered, with her hand on her belly. "If I don't talk to somebody, I'm bound to go mad, and you're the only one there is. So, what do you think?
What the baby thought was cinnamon and gingerbread. And where are we sleeping tonight, Mama?
It called out to her through sinew and bone. The way into Papa Jack's emporium was narrow, but soon she stepped into tassels of navy blue, and through a prickling veil of heat she entered the shop floor. It was big in here. Bigger than it had seemed from the street. Impossibly big, Kathy might have noticed if she wasn't so fixed on keeping her nerves at bay. Her eyes were drawn momentarily to the serpents of fabric and lace that swooped in the vaulted dome above the aisles. The mannequin of a woodcutter at her side bowed ostentatiously. A pyramid of porcelain ballerinas turned on point to display themselves at their best. The aisles were alive. She took a step, stumbled when her foot caught the locomotive of some steam train chugging past. She was turning to miss it when wooden horses cantered past in their jagged rhythms, their Cossack riders reaching out as if to threaten the train gliding by. The aisle that she chose was lined with castles at siege. Some of the dioramas were frozen, with siege towers rolled into place, but others clicked into gear at Kathy's footfall. Knights errant ran sorties with loyal companions across tabletops and shelves. On one shelf, a party of pikemen held the defence against a warband of troglodytes plucked from some Scandinavian saga. Around the corner, where more dirigible balloons were tethered, a queue was forming at a countertop. Kathy joined it, and waited until the shoppers in front had finished having their mammoths wrapped up in paper, or the pieces of their pirate galleons slotted together by expert hands. Then finally she reached the head of the queue. At the counter, a boy no older than she was battling to keep the lid of a tiny box stamped Emporium Instant Trees from springing open, while simultaneously attending to the spinning tops making a symphony on the shelves behind. "I'll be with you in one moment," he said as he finally snapped the box shut. Then he reared up. He was a good-looking young man with eyes of mountain blue and black hair growing frenzied around his shoulders. He had been attempting a first beard, but the shadow on his chin was pitiful compared to the black thatches that were his eyebrows, and there was chubbiness to his face that gave him the air of a boy much younger. "Forgive me," said Kathy, "but I'm here about the job." The boy's mountain eyes narrowed to ravines, and when he took hold of the gazette that Kathy was holding, they narrowed yet further. "Where did you get this?" Kathy was fumbling a reply, when the boy lost himself in a clamour of pages. The newspaper positively exploded around him as he searched for its front page. "Leon C.? I'm sure we get seashells from..." "Look," he said, stopping dead, "you've caught us on the hop. It was first frost this morning, which you probably know. Opening night. That means chaos and plunder, catastrophe and clamour. If you'd wanted a position, if you truly wanted a position, you'd have been here..." The boy seemed to be fighting a battle against himself. Which side won, Kathy could not tell. Stepping back, he fiddled with a latch and the counter groaned open, panels in the wood revolving out of one another at the command of pulleys and gears. As the unit came apart, and only for the briefest of moments, it froze in the air, depicting the perfect image of a snowflake. Then the snowflake fractured to reveal a way through. "You'll have to stay near. If you go wandering, there's a chance I won't find you."
"I'm sorry?"
"Well, you want a position, do you? Then you have to be interviewed. He's in his workshop, where he always is. You'll have to come this way." Kathy watched him disappear into a doorway barnacled in yet more perfect crystals of snow, and pressed her hand to her belly. "I'm sorry, little thing. Not much further now." And then, with the cries of some pretend battle exploding behind her, she wandered on. Behind the counter, a set of stairs spiraled up to the galleries above. The boy was already puffing his way around the first bend by the time Kathy reached its bottom. Swiftly, she followed after. The way was narrow. At the first landing, he took her onto a gallery from which they could look down across the bustling shop floor. From here, another door and another stair, a passageway lined with storerooms in between. Each gallery grew into the next, one door opening into an antechamber from which several other halls sprouted, and though she could have sworn they had not climbed as far,
Soon Kathy emerged onto a balcony at the very height of the Emporium's dome. Shock must have grown to the others around it, one of those tricks of London geography that marked it out as a city much older than most. Or perhaps it was a trick of perspective. For, from up here, Kathy believed it almost as big as the cathedral at St. Paul's. The boy was waiting for her at a single heavy door, oak with rivets of grey-black steel. He had already knocked when Kathy arrived, breathless from her travels. Here the walls were banked in hooks, and from those hooks there dangled the detritus of 100 unfinished toys. A jack, uprooted from its box, stared at them with delirium in its eyes. From beyond the door a voice beckoned the boy to enter, and, with an almost apologetic look, he tumbled through. From the hall Kathy peered in. The workshop was illuminated in the oranges and reds of a great hearth fire. Its walls banked in aquariums and shelves where the toys of past Christmases peered out. Nervously she waited, the silence punctured only by the tolling of the boy's feet. Finally, the footsteps came to an end. She heard something landing, the newspaper being thrown down, and the boy piped up, "I didn't know we still had this thing out." And a gravelly voice, as of a bear still sluggish from hibernation, said, "It's always there when we need it there, Emile. You know that. Why? Do you not think we need more help?" "We always need more help." "Then show her in. Let's see if she's Emporium through and through." Soon after, the boy, named Emile, reappeared. The look on his face was either panic or exasperation. "You'll have to forgive me. They need me on the shop floor. It's not as if Casper would rush to the helm when the deluge comes. No, he just preens up in his tower, lording it over the rest. And on opening night as well." He ran a hand through his hair as tangled as Briar's. "I'm Emile, by the way." He lingered longer so that Kathy had no option but to say, "I'm Kathy." At this, he clapped a heavy paw on her shoulder. "Good luck, Kathy. And remember, he isn't as awful as he sounds. He's only my father." As Kathy stepped through, her eyes took in the bellows and tools, the bundles of dried fabric that hung from the rafters like the herbs of an apothecary. It was only now, her feet crunching through wood shavings and shreds of felt, startled at a family of wind-up mice who scattered as she accidentally upended their nest, that she wondered if she had done the right thing. Running was easy, she decided, but every runaway had to arrive. And arriving seemed the most difficult thing of all. The workshop was long and narrow, swollen like an hourglass at either end. At its apex, Emile's father sat in a chair whose arms had been hewn off, so that he could overhang each side. He was a mountain of man. His square head framed by curls of white and grey, his face an atlas of fissures and cracks. But by his eyes he was undeniably Emile's father. They had paled with age, but across the workshop's length Kathy could see they had once been as vivid and blue. Now that she saw him, he seemed more like grandfather than he did father. He was old enough, at any rate, or else seemed it. The only thing about him that had any youth were his hands. They were delicately threading ruby feathers into what at first seemed the carcass of a bird. Only as she got closer did she take it for a toy, its hessian hide already thick with crimson down. Her nerves grew the closer she got. At once the workshop seemed impossibly long. The toy maker at its end shrank further and further away, while behind her the way she had walked stretched out as in a fairground hall of mirrors. She had reached the second hearth when something picked itself up from the bales of wool that covered the floor. A framework of branches and wires rose jaggedly up, enclosing camshafts and wooden pistons within. Half of the frame had been covered in muslin, threaded with hair. There was enough for Kathy to take it for a model of a deer, but so incomplete it could not rise to its feet. It turned its sightless face to her, a blind foal reaching for its mother. Finally, she stood before the toymaker. "Please, sir, I've caught you on your opening night. I'm sorry it's so late. I didn't mean to..." The man shook his head, because evidently this was a preposterous notion. "It's never too late." His voice was like snowfall, ghostly and soft. and the way his eyes tightened suggested some double meaning. Did my Emile take you through the questions?
What questions?
Bewildered, the man lifted a single finger and gestured to the gazette that had fallen at his feet. They were right here, in the vacancy. He intoned them slowly, rolling his whiskers around each one.
Are you lost? Are you afraid?
He fixed her with his eyes, as if descrying one in her silence. Are you a child at heart?
Yes,
Kathy found herself saying, resisting the temptation to turn it into a question of her own.
That's good enough for me. I have an ear for a liar. Do you remember being small, how you could tell if your mama or papa were trying to outfox you?
Something in the back of their voice always gave them away. Well, I never lost the knack. The man rose from the chair, giving the impression of a fallen tree being hauled back onto its roots. With one hand in the small of his back, he levered around to extend the other for Kathy.
My name is Jacobs, but you might call me Papa Jack.
And when she shook his hand, his fingers were not gnarled like she had expected, but smooth and soft, a painter's hands, the hands of a child. It was important to be brave. She had been brave when she stepped out of the back door, brave when she took the train and knew there was no going back. But bravery, she supposed, could not end there. Now that there was somebody else lurking inside her, she would have to be brave every day. Brave in the little things as well as the big.
You'll need showing to your room. Allow me.
There was a small bell by the workshop lathe. He lifted it in an outsized hand, and its chimes echoed all around. In the rafters above, the chimes were answered by pipe-cleaner birds.
My room?
Bed and board, remember?
You mean I'm hired?
It was the first frost of winter this morning. We don't turn folk away, not on first frost. With those words, Papa Jack sank back into his chair. In moments, the phoenix was in his lap. His fingers danced along its seams, and in their wake sprang up more feathers, crimson and vermilion and burgundy red.
You can come this way, dear.
Kathy turned. A figure was standing in the workshop door, no doubt summoned by Papa Jack's bell. She set off that way, careful not to crunch the wind-up mice still milling at her feet. Only halfway along the workshop hall did she dare to turn back.
"Sir," she ventured,
"don't you even want to know my name?" Papa Jack looked up airily. She had not noticed until now the way his white locks fell about his head, like an avalanche. His eyes had the faraway look of the fishermen she had known, those who had fought in foreign wars and come home wanting only to fish. In reply, he breathed no words, only opened his hands, and the phoenix, whose feathers he had been darning, took flight. The lady waiting in the door was not as old as Kathy supposed. She might have been no older than Kathy's own mother, and wore a look similarly severe.
"You'll let me carry your bag," she said as Kathy joined her.
Her house dress was a simple starched cotton, and on top of this she wore a holland apron.
"If it's all the same, I'll carry my own."
The lady led her along the hall, back to the galleries that overlooked the shop floor. "The master might not want your name, but I'll have it soon enough."
"It's Kathy," she replied, her eyes drawn by the confetti snowfall coalescing into clouds above the aisles.
"And you came off one of them adverts, did you?"
"I did.
That's how I found myself here as well. But that was 12 years gone, when his boys were just bairns. You'll call me Horning, Mrs. Horning, though the first name's Eva." Together they wound their way along a crooked servant's passage to the foot of a crooked servant's stair. Along the way, Mrs. Horning trilled and whispered under her breath, but Kathy could not make out a word. The way was steep, each step uneven, but there was light at the top of the stairs. The landing was cramped, barely big enough for them both to stand there together, with a door hanging open on either side. Through one lay a simple washroom with toilet bowl and tub. Kathy was about to step through the other when Mrs. Horning touched her hand and whispered,
"Are you sure about this girl?"
The question caught her off guard.
"It wouldn't be too late for you to go back, wherever it is you came from. You could make up a story. Whoever it is, they'd understand."
She stiffened. I'm sure I don't know what you mean. All of these others are here, aren't they? I can work like the best of them.
Mrs. Hornung considered her oddly. Then something shifted in her appearance. She seemed to have acquiesced to some unvoiced demand. You'll find Sally Ann on the shop floor come sunup. She's been with the Emporium too many Christmases to mention. She'll show you the ropes. Get your rest, Cathy. There's much you'll have to learn. It wasn't until Mrs. Hornung had disappeared that Cathy's heart was stilled. She wondered if the other heart was beating as rapidly. Perhaps it could sense her trepidation and beat in unison with her own. Quickly, she slammed the door shut and scrabbled to find a bolt. Only once she was sealed within did she look around. There was a bed in the corner, where the pitched roof met the wall. A steepled window looked out across black rooftops and streetlights. Half a moon hanging between towers rising up on the other side of the city. Apart from that, there was nothing.
"Are you still there?" she whispered with her hand on her belly.
She prowled around the room until she reached the window. She had not known she was so high, but there was a clarity to the air, the taste of winter's first frost. It was strange not to smell the sea. London had odours of its own. "Can't be so bad. We might have turned up at a den of thieves. They could have killed us already. No reason why they'd wait until the dead of night, creep up here and smother us with a pillow." Her eyes revolved until they landed on the door. No reason at all. The thought propelled her to heave her bed against the door, but that revealed black holes in the floorboards that had been gnawed away to reveal the pitted darkness underneath. In the end, she heaved the bed back into place. It was better to be afraid of what she knew than what she didn't. She lay down and closed her eyes. Her body was ready for sleep, but her mind was not. It kept erupting with images of Lizzie, a victim of their father's inquisition, with the idea of their mother storming to Daniel's house and demanding to search every cupboard and crawl space. "How long before they call the police?" she whispered, but the baby fluttered inside her, and to Cathy, its inference was clear. They won't call the police. They couldn't stand the shame. "So it's only me and you." "And hang them," she uttered. "They would rather you never existed." Such thoughts could turn self-righteousness to self-pity, so she concentrated on other things. She whispered instead about all the things they would do together in this, their new home. She had not thought about it when she slipped through the back door this afternoon, but now it seemed startlingly clear. This was not about a week, a month, or even a year. This was about a new existence. Perhaps we'll stay. What better place to grow up than in a toy shop? Why, you'd have everything you'd ever want. After she had lain out what few things she had, she climbed to the window ledge and looked out. Oh, but life was a strange and terrifying thing. She was still there, hours later, when the last shoppers flocked out into the winter dark, bound for the horse-drawn buses lined up against the Regent Street arcades. In their hands were bags in which confetti fireworks were already erupting. Ballerinas so impatient to get home they were already turning their tour on Lair. Behind one gaggle of shoppers, a reindeer in Hessian and felt, no doubt the ancestor to whatever half-finished contraption had been resting in Papa Jack's workshop, trotted out, only for a group of shop-hands to hurry after and corral it back onto the Emporium floor. Cathy cupped her hand to her belly. "Funny to think how close we are. An hour on a train, nothing more. And yet..." This was a different world, though it seemed so guileless to say it. She was not a child, she had to remind herself. She could not be, not with a child of her own budding inside her. "It's hardly like home, is it, little thing?" No, it didn't feel like home at all. And yet, as she hummed lullabies to soothe herself to sleep that night, one thought was knocking at the door, determined to be let in. Papa Jack's Emporium did not feel like home. But home, it would have to be. Paper Forests. Papa Jack's Emporium, Christmas, 1906. There are 100 different clocks in the Emporium. Some keep time with the comings and goings of London seasons. Others tick out of sync, counting down the hours of that faraway coastline the Godman brothers once called home.
Still more keep erratic and uncontrollable times. One counts each third second backwards, the better to extend the time between chores. Another elongates the evening, all the better to keep bedtime at bay. These are the times that children keep, and which adults are forbidden from remembering. Only a child could understand how one day might last an eternity, while another pass in the flicker of an eye. Yes, Papa Jack's Emporium is a place out of step with the world outside. Come here day or night, and you will find a place marching to the beat of its own drum. Listen, and you might hear it, even now. Emil Godman was up with the Baltic dawn, for such was the habit of his father's lifetime, and above all other things, Emil wanted to impress his father. Consequently, a full 3 hours before sunlight touched Iron Duke Mews, when it was shedding its pale winter light over the countries of the frozen east, Emil was already out of bed and in his workshop. A miniature of his father's own. Its tables were lined with wooden soldiers in various states of undress. Emil walked among them, trailing his fingers over faces half-etched, oblongs of wood waiting for the workshop lathe. According to the shop ledgers, a full 3 legions of soldiers had left the Emporium doors in the 2 weeks since opening night. Shelves that had been 18,000 strong were now depleted, and the knowledge gave Emil one of the greatest thrills of his life. Most of those soldiers were his summer's work, or else the work of last winter's craftsmen, but all of them were Emil's design. He settled into his chair, rolled up sleeves around his meaty forearms. They had his papa's girth, though he was some years away from sprouting the same wiry hair, and set to work. Simple infantrymen and cavalry he allowed the shop hands to sculpt and paint, but the Emporium's most prized pieces were for Emil alone. By the flick of a wrist, the deft twirl of a brush, and a misting of lacquer, the faces of the soldiers became known. Emil worked by rote, but he worked as if in a trance, his fingers crafting expressions that astonished him when he set each soldier down to dry. This first was of noble bearing. The second had waged too many battles before. This third carried the scars of some prior campaign and wore a look that revealed his innermost dream, to return to the sweetheart he had left behind. In this way, an hour passed in Emil's workshop, then 2 and then 3. Not a window here looked out upon the outside world, but he knew when dawn was breaking, by the rattling in the pipes, the echo of distant footsteps which told him the shop hands were up, about, and preparing for the chaos of the day. His morning's work would have to end here, with the final soldier in his hand. With a flurry of paint and varnish he crafted a face, dipped him in lacquer to create jackboots of sparkling green, adorned him with tiny brass medals and a sash of crimson red. It was only when he set the soldier down among the others that he realized what he had created. For this figurine was quite the most venerable of all. This soldier bore the many campaigns he had waged with a quiet dignity. This soldier had a single scar above his left eye, a line in the wood caused by some enemy soldier's saber. This soldier had known triumph and disaster, and treated those impostors exactly the same. He was, Emil decided, quite extraordinary. Any boy would be proud to have him among his collection. A tingle he had not felt in many months was lighting up every nerve of his body. He would have to set the shop hands to replicating it soon. Their copies would be imperfect, but they would still be toys to shout about, toys to draw the customers back. Thinking of the stories his papa once told, he decided to give it a name like no other. This, he decided, would be the first. The Imperial Capitan. The great bell in the Emporium Dome was tolling, bringing the rest of the shop hands out from their roosts. Emil hurried out of his workshop and onto the shop floor. While he had been sleeping, the night hands had transformed the displays. Theirs was a job coveted by all the rest, to come out after dark and work wonders along the atriums and aisles. This morning, an oriental dragon snaked from one end of the store to another. The atrium at the Emporium's heart had become the wilderness lair of 2 enormous black bears. The doors would not open for another 2 hours, but the first shift shop hands were already at work. Emil trod among them, eager to show the Imperial Capitan to everyone he passed, but most were too engrossed in their tasks to stop. Kesey and Dunmore, who had first come to the Emporium as astonished customers and signed up as shop hands the winter they came of age,